Okay, yesterday I said I'd go through the regions thing again, and I want to briefly do that. Very briefly, unless there are questions about it. So are there questions about what's going on with regions? Just an administrative note, I've updated the syllabus to reflect the rotation in courses. So if you go online, you can get the rotation in lectures. If you go online, you can get the new one. General idea is that a region describes a contiguous range of the application's address space. Now, I should point out that regions is a notion that's used in some form in Unix and in Windows, but it's actually not the only way to build address spaces. And later in the course, we'll look at a system that does this in a completely different way. When you use the mmap system call in Unix, what you're really building is a region entry in the region table. What I said yesterday is that when an application goes to reference a location the first time, we don't know what's there. And the way we figure out what to put there is we go down the region list, we find the region, we figure out which page the reference was in relative to the region, we go to the backing file, and we go ahead and get that page. And one of the notes that I left sort of dangling yesterday is, well, it might not be a backing file. And now I want to get to the question somebody asked yesterday about whether regions were exclusive to an address space. Suppose that I'm running two unrelated copies of the shell. So I have code and I have data in each one. But notice that the code is not going to get modified. Right, it's read-only. Can't store it. So it would sure be nice if we could tell a story that said, oh, well, since they're not going to modify the code, there's actually no reason for me to load the code twice. What I could do instead is I could have the two processes reference the same region. And if I want to do that, now what I'll have is, instead of a table of tuples like this, I'll actually have a table of pointers to tuples. And what we're going to end up with is here's the first copy of the shell, and here's the second copy of the shell. And by the way, something that I left out here is there's actually a type on the region. So we might have two regions that say, hey, here's the code and the base and the offset, and this region is read-only, and both of these guys might point to it. And also, we're going to say that it comes from bin sh offset something. This design, by the way, is slightly oversimplified. In real systems, even if you and I share code, very often we might have it mapped at different addresses. So we're actually, in the end, going to need a data structure that's a little more complicated than the region structure. I'm trying to keep the story somewhat simplified. And now we're going to run into a catch, which is that we also need a region for
the data area and the problem is that we need these two data regions to be distinct. If I store a variable in my copy of the shell, you should not see the result of the store. Right? These are separate copies, the behavior of one, barring a communication channel between them that's set up on purpose, the behavior of one should not influence the behavior of the other. So now we need two data regions. Furthermore, we need to explain how it is that these data regions can come from the same file, on the one hand, but can be private on the other. So here's the way this works. I said that regions were backed by a file section. That's not quite correct. So it is true that the very most primitive region type is a file region. However, regions can also be backed by other regions. So what we're going to do here is we're going to say, this one is going to have a permission read-write, and I'm going to come back and change that in a second, but hold on a second. And this one is going to have permission read-write, but they're not going to be backed by a file. They're going to be backed by another region which is a read-only region on the data section of slash bin slash sh. Now, how the heck is that going to work? Well, here's the second thing we'd like to do. While logically we need these data regions to be distinct, there's no point duplicating them. There's no point actually separating them until one party or the other actually does a store. Until that first store happens, you can safely continue to share the data. The catch is you have to detect when the store happens. So here's how this works. I told a slightly oversimplified story of how you search the region list. In addition to the address, there's one other piece of information provided by the hardware. The hardware tells us whether this was a load or a store operation. If it's a load operation, the procedure is pretty much the way I described it, with the revision that we may find a region that allegedly contains the address, before the first store, this data region in front is empty. It has no pages. The first time we modify a page, here's what happens. Because this region is empty, whenever we go looking for a page in this region, we're going to say, it's not in this region, it must be in the backing region. And we're going to build a tree, right? The leaf is going to be way down here somewhere. And we're just going to search from the topmost region. If we don't find it there, we'll go to the next one. If we don't find it there, we'll go to the next one. Now, so far, this seems kind of silly because I haven't told you how anything's going to end up in the top region. But the critical change here is we're going to search a hierarchy. Now, how are things going to move? Well, the first time I go to write a page, I'm going to do what's called a copy on write. This is sometimes referred to as a lazy copy. So I'm going to take the original page content, which is not yet modified. I'm going to allocate a new page frame out of memory. I'm going to copy the content to the new location. And I'm going to update the page table to point to the new location. And only now am I going to mark this location read-write. So here's the way to think about this. What's going on is, here's the file, right? Or here's the region of the file that I originally mapped. And this file is broken up into pages. But these pages of the file are read-only. In front of this, I have another region, but this other region is initially completely undefined. Okay? So what it has, I obviously put too many pages in here. They're supposed to be the same number. What it has is a bunch of undefined pages. And a backing pointer that says, if you can't find it here, go look there. And so initially, that's what's going to happen for every page. But notice that the region in the back says read only. And I told you I was going to change this permission. What we're really going to do here is we're going to say, this is writable, but only after you copy. COW stands for copy on write. So the first time I go to do a store, actually, probably I will have done a load first. So I will have built a read-only mapping. And now I go to do a store, and the hardware watched the page tables and says, you can't store there. You don't have permission to store there. Why don't I have permission to store there? Because the page table entry says this location is read-only. At this point, the operating system gets involved. The hardware causes a transition into the operating system. The operating system says, oh, there was an attempt to store, and that attempt failed. Let me go figure out why. And in fact, the hardware will tell it, it failed not because the entry was invalid, it failed because there were insufficient permissions. That usually the hardware tells you. If it doesn't, you can walk the tables and figure it out in software. What's going to happen now is, suppose the reference was to that page. Okay, so I'm going to call this P312. I'm just giving it an arbitrary name. What I'm going to do is, I'm going to make a copy of P312. And I'm going to update the corresponding frame of the foreground region to point to the copy. Okay? So what these X's really mean is, just go ahead and refer to the other page behind it, subject to the permission restrictions of the back region. But if the page is actually in the foreground region, then the permissions of the foreground region control. And since the foreground region is read-write, what's going to happen is we're going to copy the frame, we're going to copy the content, excuse me, into a new frame. We're going to update the pointer in the foreground region, and then we're going to go and adjust the page table entry to reflect what's now true. So in fact, the story I told that we were going to copy this stuff into memory is conceptually still true. It's just that we're being really lazy about it. We're deferring any possible copy until the last possible moment. Now, the reason this particular picture is important, think about what happens in the Unix system when you do a forked system call. What fork does, it takes a single process and a single address space. And after the fork, you have two processes and two address spaces, both of which are copy-on-write copies of the original space. And the way that's done is fork goes down the region list of the process that's doing the fork, and for each of those regions, it says, oh, I'll mark, if the old region was copy-on-write, maybe might have only been read-only. What I'll do is, If it was read-only, I'll leave it alone. Although, strictly speaking, I have to do a logical copy of that as well. But if it was copy on write, what I'll do is I'll build two new regions. This arrow's going the wrong way. Both of which have the old region as a predecessor. So chains of forks are how you build trees of regions. And the only reason we're building this hierarchy is to support this lazy copy on write.
So once you have in those new, after you call fork and you have the new address spaces, the regions, and you copy on write one of the new spaces, what happens to the region below it?
Well, I'm not copying on write the region. I'm copying on write individual pages in the region.
Right. So then the pages in the regions lower down in the tree on the diagram, what happens to them? I don't need them anymore. They just sit there.
Well, you still do. So in this story, in this original story, you're correct. Once I copy on write P312, I no longer need the original. And in fact, if I'm keeping track of counters, I can optimize this case and avoid the copy. I can notice, well, there's only one reference now, and at the end there will only be one reference, so I can skip the copy. And in fact, operating systems really do that optimization. But now in this case after fork, I have two new children, both referencing the previous generation. And what's going to happen is, yes, they might turn out to touch the same page, but it could turn out that those touches happen fairly well far apart. So suppose it's that page that gets copied. And then the problem is that in this address space, there's still a hole referencing that page. So until the last reference is satisfied, I can't throw the old copy away because I'm still actually using it for read purposes.
But once all the children have done a copy because they've written to that page,
then I can throw it away. Yes. And in fact, real systems really do that. They use reference count to do that.
So isn't that kind of garbage collection?
Yes. Well, strictly speaking, it's reference counting, not garbage collection. We're using reference counting to figure out when to throw things out. The people who do garbage collection work would quibble that reference counts and garbage collection are different techniques. I want to point out something else about this design. There's a rule about this design that's enforced in the Unix system. The rule goes like this. If a page is writable, it's in exactly one layer. So if I have a hierarchy like this, only the leafmost layer will contain writable pages. Nothing above the leaf. Here, once I build this structure, this layer and this layer are no longer writable. So there's no mixture of sharing. Some pages shared, some pages not shared, but all of them writable. The unit of writability is the region. So either I have a private writable region, or I have a completely shared writable region, but I never have a mixed situation. And that means that when pages are dirty, a dirty page only resides in exactly one region. You will never see a situation where a modifiable page is pointed to from more than one place. Now, why does that matter? Let me go back to this original region. We said this region was defined relative to a section of a file. Suppose I get into a situation of memory pressure. I need to free up some memory. These pages were read-only. I know they're not modified, and that means if I throw them out and I get caught, I can always go back to the file and get them again. So I can just drop them. There's a cache. And that's true for any page that has not been modified. Now, for pages that have been modified, I have a problem. I can take them out of memory, but I got to I got to be able to get the back. When I write them down, typically what happens is, if this is my disk drive, right, I have a bunch of parts of the disk, probably more than one, that are file systems. And I have another region of the disk that's commonly known as the swap area, although it turns out swapping almost never happens anymore. But these dirty pages, when I go to write them down, what I'm going to do, I'm going to allocate a frame in the swap area. And I'm going to write them down there. And then what I'm going to do is I'm going to make a bookkeeping entry that says, if you're looking for page 7 in region 21, here it is on the swap area over here. I'm going to keep a directory. That directory is going to tell me for every entry in the swap area what region it goes with, so that I can get it back. In fact, there are two kinds of operations I may need to get. I may remove this page from memory by putting it in the swap area. That's called paging it out. That's the term. I may bring it back, paging it in. Or it could be that the process will exit, it will declare that it's done with this region, and then I need a way to go through and mark all of those regions of the swap area are now free. All the corresponding pages in the swap area are now free. Yeah.
If I want to keep the changes that were put in the swap area permanently,
then it's the application's responsibility to write them back to a file. Ignoring memory map files which are map shared. There's some fine print there. That's a case where we will actually page them out to the file, not to the swapper directly. Okay, so, yeah.
The swap area is only written to first frames that have been modified.
Yes.
Otherwise, it uses the original file.
Yes.
As the back.
Yes.
If you start running the program and you delete the file, it's still in memory. And ostensibly, it could need to drop something, but the page itself is not.
In Unix, the answer to this question is, if you have a file mapped, that can only occur because you have previously opened the file. If you look at the interface to mmap, which is what's really being implemented here, you'll discover that the argument to mmap that describes the file is a file descriptor. In order to get that descriptor, you had to do an open. When you did an open, there was a reference count maintained on the file that got increased. So the rule in Unix is, you can delete the file all you want. The file doesn't actually go away until its reference count goes to zero. So if you actually look down at the implementation, when you rm a file, and if you dig down into the OS, what you'll see is, internally, the call that's really made is something called unlink. And what unlink actually does is it decrements the reference count on the bookkeeping data structure associated with that file. Every open increments that reference count. Every close decrements that reference count.
If you do an ls-l.
Every link increments that reference count. Sorry?
Right. If you do an ls-l, you'll see the number of links to a particular file. Is
yes.
that the same as the reference count?
Yes. No. That would be the number of links from the file system.
Right, okay.
Okay. So what happens is when the file gets opened, an in-memory data structure gets built in association with it, that in-memory data structure carries additional reference counts. Yeah?
How much space is usually allocated for reference count?
Typically 32 bits.
Okay, so you're storing the full registry. I'm just worried about reference count overflows.
Reference count overflows. Okay, so let's think about this. In order to get a reference count overflow, what would I need to do? I would need to have so many opens, right? I need basically 2 to the 32 simultaneous opens on the same file.
Plus 1.
Plus 1. Actually, strictly speaking, I only need 2 to the 32 because 0 doesn't count. Right? So what would it take to get 2 to the 32 opens on the file? Well, I'd have to actually do the opens, and each of those opens is going to allocate a data structure to record the open file bookkeeping information. That data structure has to live somewhere. What you're going to discover is the data structure is bigger than the counter. And so in order to allocate that many data structures, I would have long since exhausted physical memory. In fact, I will have long since exhausted kernel virtual memory. You're right to ask, what happens if the counter overflows? But in this case, there are other things that will get you first, and those other things get checked. It is, however, for robustness, it's actually quite important to reason your way through that class of questions. So in this case, the answer is, yes, hypothetically, the counter would overflow, but you can show that in any circumstance where the counter might overflow, you will previously have had a malloc failure trying to allocate the structure that's going to actually contain the pointer to this thing you're counting. That's a statement about what's true in all real kernels. For a new kernel, you'd have to revalidate that statement. Okay, so the idea here is we're doing all of our page I.O. on demand. And the question is, what happens when we do that? So I want to switch gears, right? I've talked about a data structure, and now I want to talk about performance implications. Why does this work? And the idea is that my program is going to spend most of its time in some small subset of the code. And that's probably true for a lot of reasons. Certainly, it's true at the level of caches everywhere else, and you wouldn't necessarily expect it to be magically violated here. What are the advantages? Well, for a given amount of memory, I can therefore squeeze more programs in and actually get them to do something useful. Also, to get a program started, I have to do less work. Specifically, think about it, what's the minimum I need to get a program going? Right? I need the first page of its code. Realistically, very, very soon after that, I'm going to need the first page of data. And very soon after that, I'm going to need the first page of stack. I mean, the dynamic frequencies are that something like 30-40% of instructions are loads or stores, and those are all to data. So I'm going to need data within the first two or three instructions. Right? And then I'm going to see a procedure call. Those are high frequency as well. Or I'm going to see a save of something to a temporary location. Those all go on the stack, so I'm going to need a stack. Right? But if I have those three pages in memory, hey, my process is making progress. And in fact, on all real processors, here's a curious tidbit. There's a lower bound on the number of pages where if you have this number of pages dedicated to the process, you can guarantee that the process will make progress. It will execute, it has enough storage to execute an instruction. Specifically, it has enough pages that it can execute whatever the most stupidly designed instruction in the architecture is. On the Pentium, the magic number is something like 11 pages. On RISC architectures, it's generally 3. And it has to do with what are all the complications of what might get referenced as you go through an instruction. Now, the problem with this story is then, very shortly, the application is going to run off of that first page and say, well, I'd like to execute some more, but I need the next page of code, please. And we have memories now that run in nanoseconds, but we have disk drives that run in tens of milliseconds. And that's the sync time, right? And then you do a routine. You go to the store and you buy a 9 millisecond disk drive nowadays, right? And that's a funny number, right? That says under some absurd assumptions that never happen in practice, it will, on average, take 9 milliseconds for the disk head to get from wherever it is to wherever you want it. And we're going to talk a lot about how to alter that number later. That turns out not to be the bad news. The bad news is rotation.
It really matters. The single biggest thing you can do to speed up your disk performance, get a drive with a higher rotation speed, because it turns out that the sync time is something that the OS can play with, but the rotation time is really just kind of stuck. And if you have a drive that's 7,200 RPM, right, you can calculate for yourself what's the time for that platter to go around in a circle. And on average, you're going to have to wait for half a rotation in addition to the sync time. And then you're going to have to transfer data. It turns out the actual data transfer, it's noise. All the time is spent in the sync and the rotate. So on a 9-millisecond drive, by the time you're done with this nonsense, you're looking at 15 milliseconds. That's a hell of a lot compared to a 2-nanosecond memory time. It's a 6-decimal order of magnitude, maybe a 7-decimal order of magnitude jump. Right? Nanoseconds, microseconds, milliseconds, it's a big, big jump. So, ask yourself the following question. Suppose I waved my hands and I said, we're going to squeeze about 1,000 instructions into a page, and let's imagine the most favorable conditions, execution is just going to go in a straight line. Actually, strictly speaking, it would be more favorable if it ran in a little loop inside the page. But let's imagine execution is going to go in a straight line. So what's going to happen now? What's my time going to be in this demand paging policy? I'm going to run 1024 instructions. Now I'm going to ignore the data cache, and I'm going to ignore the instruction cache. And each of these 1024 instructions is going to take me 2 nanoseconds. And even I can do this arithmetic, although I am impaired being a computer scientist. Computer scientists need calculators, right? But then I'm going to fall into the next page, and I need to go get it from the disk, okay? And so at that next instruction, all of a sudden, I'm going to take a 15-millisecond hit for the page fetch, right? And then I'm going to do my next 1,000 instructions. Anybody happen to know how many nanoseconds to a millisecond? A million. Okay. So let's translate this into microseconds, right? That's 15 times 10 to the 6, is it? And just to sort of simplify things, let's just renumber this. Just moving the decimal point. Where do you imagine you're going to spend all of your time in this machine? If I double the speed of main memory, would you give a damn? You'd get 0.1% improvement. All right, here's how you calculate this kind of thing. You take the fraction of operations at one cost, and you add it with the fraction of the operations at the other cost. So in this case, I did a very funny measure. And let me now go back and unpack these numbers. Okay. What we're really saying here is that I'm going to do 1023 instructions at 2 nanoseconds. But in order to do those 1023 instructions, I'm first going to have to do one instruction that's at 15 milliseconds plus 2 nanoseconds, right? The 15 milliseconds are to get the page. The 2 nanoseconds are after I've got the page to do something about it. And you'll often find that this, when you work out this equation, that it's of the form, all the instructions have some common cost. And some fraction of the instructions have a second cross, P being the percentage. So I asked you, what's the average cost per instruction on this machine?
Right?
You'd say, well, every instruction takes 2 nanoseconds. And one in 1,000 takes 15 milliseconds. And we can cancel the 1024 and the 15 milliseconds. I'm sorry, let me use consistent notation here. To get microseconds, right, and then we'll multiply by another 10 to the 3 to get from microseconds to nanoseconds. There are two classes of error that people make when they're computing this. Number one, they forget to normalize the units. Sorry, you can't add nanoseconds and milliseconds without converting one into the other. The other thing is they don't factor the behavior correctly. So let me explain that this equation has yet another expanded form because you can see this behavior across multiple layers. So, for example, you might say, well, every reference to my level one cache takes a nanosecond. But some percentage of them I don't get from the level one cache. Now, for that percentage, I have a second problem, which is separate problem. What's going to happen at the level two cache? I might say, everything I get from the level 2 cache takes 4 nanoseconds. But some percentage of those aren't going to be in the level 2 cache. So for those, I have a third problem. What happens to the main memory? And you end up with a nested bracketing of this equation. And we're going to do equations like this again and again and again. And I'll give an example of a nested case shortly. So this number is really awful, right? This 15 milliseconds is a killer. Suppose I knew the application was going to go in a straight line. And they offer you the following choice. I'll double your memory speed. I'll give that to you pretty much for free. Or instead of fetching one page at a time, I'll fetch two. Which one do you want me to do?
Which two pages?
Fetch two. We said the program's going sequentially, right? So fetch two in sequence. Why?
Because you're not going to have to spin the disk a second time to seek that. It's going to be...
I didn't say I was getting it from a disk. I only told you how long it takes. You're right. That's the underlying story about why. And the lesson there is a change in technology might change the story. But what we're interested in here is latency. So where's the latency benefit? Where am I saving delay by doing this?
In your 15
milliseconds. Am I? Did I change the 15 milliseconds? I know you know. Well, where did the 15 milliseconds come from?
The time it takes to put that into memory.
No. Actually, what I said was that was the negligible part of the time. So where did that 15 milliseconds come from? Think about a disk drive.
Seeking it.
Right. It was mechanical delays in the physical structure of the drive. Am I going to magically get rid of any of those? Not without an awful lot of magic. So I didn't reduce to 15 milliseconds. I did get 2 pages for it, and I will wave my hands for a moment because we haven't talked about how. But let me wave my hands and say basically for almost exactly the same 15 milliseconds, there is a slight difference, but it's negligible for our purposes, I can get 2 pages. So what did I change? change the divisor. I change the amortization of the cost over the instructions. So if I fetch two pages, potentially, I'll actually see a factor of two improvement in overall execution. If I double your memory speed, potentially, I'll see a factor of roughly nothing improvement in total execution. Now here's a puzzle for you. In spite of what I just said, if you're looking at an upgrade for your laptop, you're much better off increasing memory than you are increasing the processor on those laptops. You had a question back here? I'll come back to why. All right. Well, so why shouldn't I always grab two pages?
Or three or four.
Or three or four. Hell, why don't I just slurp the whole disk, right? I mean, it's not that big, right? Memory's cheap. Why shouldn't I slurp two pages all the time?
How do you know what page? Can you send the hard drive cache again?
You actually can often send the hard drive cache a hint on modern drives. The catch is, that hint is not without a cost, right? You are going to initiate that I.O. The only question is you're going to move the bits. So if the drive is idle, sure. But actually, the drive cache is relatively small.
Well, when you're doing a disk load, you're waiting for 15 milliseconds. You're not just going to stare at your hands. If you stay a page ahead, so when the app starts, you load two pages, and you load each page once in advance. So during that 15 milliseconds, you're still executing other code.
I'm going to do some other thing. Yeah, sure. All right, but why shouldn't I load two pages all the time? I mean, you're right. I'm not going to sit there twiddling my thumbs. Actually, when I first power on the machine, I'm actually going to spend a very great deal of time twiddling my thumbs because I haven't loaded enough stuff to have anything else to do yet. Right. One of the great bugs in Windows and Linux, you may have noticed when your screensaver kicks in, if you walk away long enough, when you come back and touch the shift key and you throw out your screensaver, the next thing that happens is your disk is right. That's because Linux took all the stuff in your memory and flushed it out the disk because you weren't using it. Now it has to get it all back. Why? Because all the applications have just been asked to redraw their display and they're all going I always wanted to be the Red Baron as a kid. Okay. Why shouldn't I grab two pages every time? Or four? All right, why shouldn't I grab 100 pages every time? Let's just sort of crank this up to a ridiculous extreme. Anybody want to take a cut? Why shouldn't I grab 100 pages every time?
The program cannot be run literally, so you don't know what the next page will be.
What's the likelihood that I'm going to do 100 pages of execution in a straight line? How many of you have written a program without a branch or a procedure call? How many of you have written more than 5 lines of code without a branch or a procedure call? Actually, the answer is most of you, but very few have written 8 lines of code without a branch or a procedure call. The observed dynamic frequency of branch and call instructions is about 15%, which is about 1 in 7 in round numbers. So the likelihood I'm going in a straight line for 100 pages is like zero. What about 2 pages?
Well, it's usually good to look ahead, but even if your execution of an entire page takes 1024 times 2 nanoseconds, you're still going to be waiting on that second. You're going to be waiting anyway.
Okay, what's the cost of bringing in the other page? Ain't nothing for free in this life. What's the cost of bringing in the other page? What's going to happen if I bring in that other page? What do I have to do to bring in that other page?
Well, you're going to have to copy it somewhere.
I got a place to put it. What do I got to do to get a place to put it? Here's how this works, okay? Listen, I really need your chair. Could you move for me?
It's going to happen if I need a place to put somebody. I'm going to have to boot somebody else out. Not the person. Don't worry, I'll put you out of the mix. Don't kill with that. I'm going to have to take some other page out of memory. Now, if that other page is idle, cool, get rid of it. But how do I know? I don't have an oracle. All I've got is a statistical expectation. Furthermore, I don't know that you're going to use this next page. I do have a little bit, a limited amount of opportunity to say, oh, based on past predictive, past behavior, it's a reasonable guess that you're going to ask for the next page. And there are a couple of places where you're really likely to ask for the next page. Up to a point, growing your stack is a good bet. In many phases of a program, access to the heap will tend to go in a straight line because you're allocating lots of memory in a straight line. Good bet I should get those pages in advance if I need those pages. There are windows of time when you execute code in a fairly well-defined region. Good bet I should try to get those pages ahead because with high likelihood you're going to need them. Here's an interesting problem. By the time I've gathered enough data to conclude that you're going in a straight line, you're probably not going in a straight line anymore. These kinds of predictive behaviors, the ones where we can predict robustly, are actually quite rare. And they tend to have sort of very short duration. There are a few examples of programs that benefit from this, and they really benefit, but it's very tough to do this right.
How big is the jump? Maybe if you decide how many pages you load, if you typically jump around within one page, then there's a run. If you jump around,
very often you'll jump around within one or two pages.
So if you, if you jump around within two pages, maybe it makes sense to load two pages.
Okay, but there's some threshold where it stops making sense anymore, right? And also, I might say, look, you know, if my memory's basically empty, I might as well grab two. Right? I could tune it that way as well. All right. Tomorrow, I'm going to start on this problem of how to decide who to kick out. And I would appreciate it if you would take the time this evening to have a look at your textbook and look in particular at the example for Bilotti's anomaly. But here's the punchline. Adding more memory does not always help. If you're not careful about it, in some cases, adding more memory will for sure change your program behavior, but it might turn out to change it for the worse. So there's a bunch of tricks about this that we're going to have to look at. So what I want to talk about tomorrow is how to decide what to throw out and what are the cases you have to watch out for. Okay.